We're back with Beatles scholar and NPR critic Tim Riley on a tremendously creative and influential life that was cut short 31 years ago on December 8th.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Field.
Tim is out with Lennon, The Man, the Myth, and His Music, a book praised for its insight and unvarnished portrait of John Lennon. Tim, put your critic hat on for a minute as we roll back to two songs that you write reveal the differences in the Lennon-McCartney partnership, both personally and creatively. This song, Strawberry Fields Forever by John Lennon, and Penny Lane by Paul McCartney, both released in 1967 during the Sgt. Pepper sessions.
The title of that song is referring to a charity home near where John Lennon grew up. It's called Strawberry Fields. You can still go see it. Many people still visit as kind of a pilgrimage. And Lennon used to hop the walls of that home because it had a great yard with trees, and it's a childhood idol for him. So he was writing this song in the fall of 66 after the Beatles had taken their last world tour together, and he was really seriously thinking about leaving the band at this point, which at the time was kind of unimaginable to think he'd be in the biggest act of the history of show business. But he had grown really tired, and they had pushed the Beatles as far as they could with Revolver. You know, they've really just taken things much further than anybody expected them to go, even by 1966. I mean, seriously thinking, what's next? And, of course, what's next is Sgt. Pepper, another triumph. But along the way, they decide, well, let's write songs about our childhood. So he comes and he plays this Strawberry Fields Forever alone on a stool with the acoustic guitar. And there's a quote from George Martin, their producer, who says, "It was easily like the high point of my life hearing Lennon sing that song for the first time." You can imagine.
Sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree.
And then McCartney goes off and writes, you know, what is essentially an answer song, which is, oh, yeah, I'll write about my view of the same things. And he writes about Penny Lane, which is a bus roundabout. For McCartney, it is really quite an interesting philosophical conundrum, because there's that wonderful line in the song about how the nurse is selling poppies from a tray, and although she feels she's in a play, she is anyway.
Penny Lane is in my ear and in my eye. For a fish and
so he clearly is drawing on Lennon's idea of his Liverpool childhood as being a kind of surreal place, as though all the normal things that they had as children, they did kind of sparkle in their own way, and that's what you get from these two songs.
You say drawing on, not trying to one-up, not trying to outdo, you don't see that?
Well, they always described it as a very competitive relationship, so they were trying to one-up each other, but it's interesting that you know, McCartney chooses fairly standard pop music structures, and he's always trying to reach a very wide audience. He has a very innate pop sense, very melodic, very cheerful, very upbeat. And you think, oh, that's just a bright, sunny pop song. But it really does have this interesting thought riddle right in the center of it. And he gets away with that because he's so cagey in many other aspects of it. Lennon is just right out there with his experimental nature. I mean, he's just got a completely surreal idea for a song. Doesn't have refrains, doesn't have regular verses. All of the images in the song are completely original. He's writing completely outside the box with the song.
Now, the other picture we get of John in the book is as somebody who is bad at confrontation, who is bad at leaving. Some examples are how he leaves his wife, Cynthia, the mother of his child, Julian, and how he leaves the Beatles. And I wonder if you could illuminate that for us in any way.
Yeah. What you have with Lennon is, you know, he's somebody who externalized this incredible personality. Everybody knows the big, chatty side of Lennon. He was a quote machine. He was a big personality. Big-humored, big-hearted, sentimental, blustering, you know, could project a really terrific facade to the world at large. But in his intimate relationships and the people he was closest to, he was extremely meek, it seems, and fearful, and avoided confrontation at all costs. So the received wisdom has always been that Yoko Ono sort of kidnaps him and breaks the band up. And I really found some very, very different kinds of evidence that that's really not true. The first being that Lennon, you know, was certainly the only member of the Beatles who could have brought someone like Yoko Ono into rehearsals with the band. That really was not something that was done. So Lennon initiates doing this, and he insists on her voicing her opinions and becoming kind of a band member herself without asking any of the other Beatles or even introducing her to the producer, George Martin. He really never takes responsibility for doing it. He lets Yoko take the rap for breaking the band up. But, you know, he is the one who's insisting that she be there the whole time.
Cynthia, his ex-wife, describes the scene where she basically comes home and finds that Yoko has moved in.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't imagine a more difficult breakup scene. So Cynthia's gone off to Italy for a short vacation. And when she comes home, she finds Yoko lounging in her slippers in the Lennon family
room. It's like an old R&B song or something.
Right, right. And Lennon, and they barely acknowledge Cynthia. It's though, you know, like Lennon has just had this lover overnight, and the wife can stuff it, basically. His both of their behavior is really pretty indefensible in a scene like that. Now, from Cynthia, we know that they get together even after that. They reconcile. They've been working on this marriage for a couple of years, but he's kind of still pulled too much to Yoko, and he winds up choosing Yoko. But the way he does it is just so cruel and heartless. Not just to Cynthia, but to the young child, Julian.
Well, you also write that about the time that he gets together with Yoko, there were some delusions, or at least him sharing with the rest of the band and Apple officials, that he was Jesus Christ. I mean, is this a mental breakdown, or is this just too many drugs? What do you think was going on for him?
I think the research that I've done shows that he was much more depressed and much more drug dependent than we ever knew, so that when he does finally settle with Yoko, that would be the spring of 68, he is sort of coming out of this massive depression, and Yoko is this, she's like a portal to a whole new life, and that's what he sees in her, and that's what he uses her for, and that's his escape hatch. And there is this very funny story about him calling a meeting with all the Beatles and announcing that he's Jesus Christ. It's a bizarre episode, and yet, you know, for Lennon, it's not as bizarre as it would be for many other people. I think it's a mental breakdown. I think it's drugs. I think it's egomania. You know, none of us know what it feels like to be John Lennon. He was an astronaut, right? He was adored by everybody in the world, and yet he felt really, really depressed and isolated. And you don't know how that feels. I mean, the air is really thin up there, and it's very, very hard to get inside somebody's head who's the object of global adoration.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Tim Riley is with us. He's author of a new biography of John Lennon, who was killed on December 8th, 1980. Well, one of the things that you do, Tim, in your book is debunk that myth that he was indeed a working class hero.
When you go to Liverpool and you get in the cab and you tell the cabbie that you're working on a book about John Lennon, the first thing all the cabbies said to me was, well, he was no working class hero. Let me just be clear about that. He was raised in Woolton. He was given a proper middle class upbringing. He was a good middle class boy. In fact, he was the only Beatle who was raised with indoor plumbing. What he's singing about there is the British class system. And so he's a lifelong opponent of this class system, and the Working Class Hero song is a very embittered and ironic statement of defiance about how false and misleading this whole class system really is.
Then they expect you to pick a career.
He does find refuge with Yoko in New York, at least a refuge from British taxes, and becomes a kind of American John. I have to roll us through the years here and mention the infamous Lost Weekend when Yoko kicks him out. He spends about 18 months in L.A. making records with Harry Nilsson, getting into a lot of trouble. Although his lover, May Pang, tells you that John and Yoko were talking every day for hours, so maybe not so lost after all. Paul McCartney, of all people, plays middleman in getting the back together, and John eventually moves back into the Tocoto for what, from the outside, seemed to be his last blissful years.
I have testimony from a lot of different people about it's not really as clean and simple as they wanted to portray it to people.
Yeah, that's what I wonder, Tim. I mean, right. How does somebody with this kind of an ego, this kind of habits for drugs and alcohol, suddenly settle down and everything's supposed to be okay?
Well, this is another much misunderstood aspect. this last five-year leg of his life where he is basically retired from the music industry and simply being a house husband. They have their son, Sean. He wins his court case to stay in America, and he settles down, and she sort of gives him the freedom at this point to not feel compelled to sing and write and perform. And he earns a long, peaceful rest from the craziness of the business. And if you're John Lennon, it really is the most okay that it's ever been. And it does seem as though he's weaned himself off many, many drugs, and that he devotes himself quite fully to this young child, and that the child really inspires new things in him, and he's very devoted to this new family. I mean, it is as much of a leap forward as you might possibly hope for from somebody like John Lennon.
Well, let's hear from just one of the most touching and lovely testaments of that love of John Lennon for his little boy, Sean. This is Beautiful Boy.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on the run and your daddy's here.
We lose when John Lennon was killed?
Well, we lost a great comic spirit. I mean, I like to think of him at age 71 now. I think he'd be just fantastically entertaining old guy who would be right down at the front lines of Occupy Wall Street, picketing, chanting slogans, writing songs for these guys. He definitely would have gotten a kick out of Occupy Wall Street. You know, I like to think that he would have kept on writing. His writing was launching into a new direction. A lot of people didn't like that it was softer, it was more composed, it was less experimental. But I think he would have found his way to a new area where he would have treated us to a whole raft of new songs. And you can think of many other partnerships he might have been involved with over the years.
All right, Tim Riley, dare I ask if you have a favorite or most emblematic Beatles song that we can leave the audience with?
I like to choose Don't Let Me Down. He's kind of waving goodbye to the Beatles as they play this song. There's this very strong sense of Beatle twilight in this song that I quite like.
Tim Riley, I want to thank you so much for opening up some of the myth, the music, and the man of John Lennon for us today.
Thank you, Virginia.
Tim Riley is a professor of journalism at Emerson College. He's an NPR critic and author, most recently, of Lennon, The Man, the Myth, and His Music. You'll find more on the book, including some emphatic notices from the New York Times Book Review, at wordofmouthradio.org. We hope that you learned something new about John Lennon on this, the 31st anniversary of his death. We thought it was worth going a little overtime with Tim, and maybe even to imagine something new today. Please do join us again tomorrow at noon and at 9 p.m. for more Word of Mouth from NHPR.